Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Lost in Science. 30 minutes, excellent science, right here, right now. We're so glad that you're joining us. My name is Lyndon and with me today I've got Chris. How are you going, Chris?
I am fantastic, thank you, Lyndon. Looking forward to some amazing topical science, I guess.
I'm hoping we'll be topical. I think your story is maybe a bit topical than mine. What do you want to talk about today?
Well, it's summer here in Australia, so I thought I would talk about snow and ice. this is actually topical. Hear me out. I've got our constraints. It's because the Winter Olympics are on, and from what I can gather, not being a big aficionado of this kind of genre of sport, it basically, all of it seems to involve things sliding around on snow or ice. So I had a little bit of a look at that. It turns out it's one of those wonderful situations I like where it's pretty much an everyday thing, as in literally, well, not everyday here, but like, as I said, every event in the Winter Olympics, but the physics of it is not well understood, or as well understood as you would expect.
Hang on. So you're saying it's basic stuff sliding around on stuff, reducing friction. It's a reducing friction Olympics, but we don't quite understand it.
How it works. We kind of understand. I'll explain. I'll have to explain later. I mean, there's a lot of, in my looking at this, there's a lot of very confident people and then someone else telling them they're wrong and for obvious reasons. So,
oh my God. Yeah. Wait, are we talking about the athletes or the scientists?
The scientists.
Okay, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, you say you're not an aficionado, but that's exactly what Olympics are about, right? Where you get to sit on the couch and say, oh, didn't nail that jump. Ooh, they should have, you know, brought their sticks closer to their chest when they were trying to do four somersaults in the air on their skis.
Oh, they should not have attempted that with a broken ACL or torn ACL. Yeah. Are you at all topical in your science?
Look, it feels topical to me. Maybe the frequency of the topicality is a little bit different. You're talking about the Winter Olympics that happens every 4 years. And I wanted to do a bit of a deep dive today into auroras, these things that tend to happen semi-regularly, but peak in their frequency around about every 11 years. So they're, you know, the colours in the sky Olympics. That's not going to catch on. But I wanted to talk a little bit about that. We had a big event earlier this year. We've had a couple of big events in 2024, I think, in May and October, as we sort of approach and then hit this solar maximum where there's a maximum of sunspots. So I wanted to dive into maybe a few of the technical terms that you've seen floating around on Facebook or that your mate's talking about. The different cycles that are relevant for catching those beautiful dancing lights in the sky, what the different lights mean, where the different places are where you've got your best chance of seeing them as we kind of move out of the solar maximum 25 where we are now. Is that topical?
I think so.
I don't know.
It sounds like it's very current, as in check it out now before it's gone.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
Science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far? Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
All right, yes, you're listening to Lost in Science. My name is Chris, and I am talking about snow and ice and how it works in terms of the kind of activities you'll see at the Olympics. Lyndon, what's your view on like skating and skiing and that kind of stuff?
It's not something that I grew up doing. From That's a fair, climate change point of view, I feel a bit of grief about it. maybe, because we know that there are, the ski seasons are going to be shorter and low level snowfall in particular is sort of becoming less common. So that's how I feel about it.
Okay. That's fair. That's fair.
How do you feel about it?
Oh, look, I guess similar to you, I did not grow up with it. I don't know. I mean, you do think that there are some parts of the world, I'm sure, where people just skate around or ski around for transportation. Yes, true. So,
you're right.
Yeah. But anyway, so it is like, it is something that we've all seen before and seems like it should be one of those very basic things. But as I said in the introduction, the physics of how skating and skiing work is, I don't think it's as well understood as we think it is. It's, okay, certainly not as well understood as most people think it is. Whether it is actually well understood now in terms of the scientific community remains to be seen, because it is something that regularly people publish papers on saying they found some new breakthrough on it.
Breakthrough on how people do a thing that they're already doing, or how to maximize
how it actually speed works, the physics or efficiency of what's happening, how or why it actually things works. Slide on the ice. Yeah.
Oh, are you talking like the molecular level in terms of, I'm thinking about a metal ice skate going through some ice and the kind of melting of the ice and then the reforming. Like, is that the level that you're talking about?
Yeah, but how is it working? How does it work? What makes it slippery? What makes the ice slippery? What makes skates work? That kind of thing. So look, let's dive in. It's not necessarily molecular, okay? So, but let's dive in. So the most common explanation that you will find if you look this up is something that was essentially sort of in the 19th century. And it's that it's pressure melting is the term they often use. Basically, there is a relationship with ice. If you increase the pressure, the melting point of it decreases. And so the theory is that, say, if you get an ice skate, that's very sharp point, is a very high pressure underneath the blade of the skate, and that melts the ice and has a water layer that the skate slides on top of. And as you said, then the water refreezes behind the skate once the pressure is removed, et cetera, et cetera. This is the common explanation that you will see. Have you heard of this?
It makes sense when you explain it logically like that, but I'm thinking then why aren't ice skaters big burly blokes? Because they would be heavier and maybe get more pressure, so they'd get more melting, so they'd get faster.
Well, not necessarily. Because depending on what kind of skating you're doing. Like if you're a figure skating, then you want to jump up in the air. You want to be a bit light to be able to do that as well.
Yeah, that's true.
But look,
but then what about something like a toboggan? I guess you wouldn't put that on flat ice, would you? Where the pressure is more evenly distributed. You don't get that a big area of melted ice.
So, okay, you're starting to figure this out. So, yeah, there is a couple of things that disprove this concept. And, yeah, toboggans, I guess you could even just say skis, which have a flat surface and don't, basically slide across snow fairly effectively. And another one that disproves it is ice hockey for two reasons. One is that this notion of, the pressure melting the ice and having a water layer, that the calculations were done, I think, like about 1899, someone did these calculations. And it kind of worked out that there wasn't a very strong pressure underneath the blade of a skate, but it only worked down to about -3.5 degrees Celsius. And often, usually ice skating rinks are much colder than that, particularly for something like ice hockey, where they need to go very fast, to have it very cold, I think about -20 degrees Celsius. And so under that theory, it shouldn't work. But not only that, I don't know if you've seen ice hockey, they hit around this puck.
Yes.
Very light little thing. It's not adding much pressure itself, but it's sliding around beautifully. So something else is going on. Enter an Australian physicist, Frank Bowden, who was hanging out in, I think, in Austria or Switzerland in the 1930s and was a big, fan of skiing and he started wondering about how this worked. And he did some experiments which showed that the pressure theory wasn't correct. And he was a big expert on friction. And so his theory was that it was actually friction, heating due to friction, that is making the ice or the snow melt. And that's what...
Oh, rather than the pressure.
Rather than the pressure.
It was the friction.
And he did some nice experiments to demonstrate this. Like for instance, he looked at, I think he had different kinds of skis. He used metal skis and wooden skis, and found that metal skis, which conduct the heat away better, they did not slide as well as, say, wooden skis, which would have built up more heat from the friction. So yeah, he did some very clever experiments and figured out that yes, indeed, it was likely to be the heat from the friction. However,
the heat from the friction that was melting
when you slide a ski,
melting the very thin layer,
skate along the ice, then it rubs against the surface of the ice or snow, and it melts a little bit and creates this thin layer of water, and then that is what it slides along.
And the puck, coming back to the puck, so.
Well, the puck
if
is
you,
sliding along, so you could say that maybe it's the same kind of phenomenon going on.
But does it leave behind a small trail of like a very thin layer of melted ice, like a snail trail?
It would freeze again. I mean, it's very, like I said, the ice hockey rinks are very cold, so yeah. But look, you're quite right. There are problems with this theory as well.
Okay,
and one of them is that I don't know if you've ever tried to walk on ice without skates. You slip over pretty easily.
Yeah.
Ice is slippery without you sliding something heavily along it. You know, it's just slippery itself. And so there's something else a bit more going on there as well. It turns out it's probably a bit of a combination of all these things happening. But this one, you know, we've got all these people trying to figure out this stuff. As time goes on, it turns out that it was actually Michael Faraday in the early 19th century who figured out perhaps the right answer, which is that ice actually does have kind of a little sort of quasi-liquid layer over the top of it. And it's something that they call pre-melting, where basically you have something where the surface of it has a little kind of melted layer that's at a lower temperature than the whole body of the things. Now, Faraday, when he was doing this, he wasn't looking at skating or skiing. What he was doing, he was looking at why ice cubes will stick together if you put two ice cubes together. And it's because there's a melted layer that then freezes when you stick them together, essentially. But yeah, this seems to be why ice is naturally slippery, but then obviously you slide something along, you get this friction effect as well, which will increase the amount of the melted layer. There are still some problems with the whole idea. It's still not fully explained by this theories, because one of the things that I just reading various papers about this, one of the things someone pointed out was that if you have a wet floor, it's got a water layer on it, it's nowhere near as slippery as ice. So water itself is not a great explanation. Like if you had a skate on a puddle of water, it's not going to slide along. So there's something more than just water going along here.
You say the answer's not molecular, but I feel like it is. I feel like it's about the way that the molecules sort of sit together in ice. And another question is, if we do somehow get to a magical solution or formula or answer combining Faraday and, what did you say his name was, Bowden, and all of these ideas to a, you know, universal theory of everything slippery and slidey, what is that going to do for people?
Physicists like to understand the way the world works, let's be honest.
That's a valid reason. If we're chasing excellence,
in the Olympics,
chasing, you know, in the Olympics, is this something that elite sports people are doing as well, you know, that 1% better every time, if we can get the ice at exactly the right temperature to maximize this theory or to hone in on this thing?
I mean,
do you know if this physics is being used
by
elite sports people?
There's the opposite as well. Like you might want to stop things getting slippery, you know, when they're iced.
Yeah, safety is also a thing. Yeah,
look,
I get that.
Look, just to jump to like the latest sort of conclusions, it's, I don't know about a molecular thing, but the view seems to be that the actual kind of layer you get is a mixture of ice and water. It's not just all water and it's not just ice. It's kind of, like I said, it's sort of a quasi-liquid. It's kind of a mixture, so it has different properties to just water. So it's different viscosity. It's got some elasticity that allows it to, like if you step on a puddle of water, then the water will be pushed out from the different sides. So you put a skate on a puddle of water, there's not going to be much water underneath the blade of the skate. It's going to get pushed out. Whereas this experiments have shown that whatever is happening underneath the blade of the skate is actually a mixture of ice and water. So it has slightly different mechanical properties to water itself. That research is still ongoing. But in terms of other uses for it, I mean, sure, if you want to improve your Olympic performance, but things like the this melted layer on the outside has been observed in other substances as well. Like lead, for instance, apparently like lead melts at around 327 degrees Celsius, but from about 307 degrees, you get this kind of melted layer on the outside of the metal. So it's seen in other materials as well. And so potentially there are some other applications of understanding how, you know, in terms of material science and understanding how this property works. But like I said, it's still doesn't seem to be a fully solved problem. And there are other, you know, ice and water have their own unique properties that perhaps don't apply to every other material. There's also other materials that have their own kind of slipping properties, like diamond apparently is quite slippery, but maybe is using a different mechanism. So it is about understanding how the materials work, whether it is something that is unique to water that can be exploited in some way, or something that is common to other materials that we can help us understand how these things work. It's all about, you never know where the benefit is going to come, Lyndon.
This is just another week, Chris, of you coming in here and talking about something that I thought we knew everything about. You know, when you talked about static electricity last year, I was like, what? That's not a story. That's just a balloon being rubbed on someone's head. But, you know, we know sweet nothing about that, apparently. And now we know nothing about skating as well. I've got a whole new sense of appreciation for those figure skaters and those athletes.
They clearly don't know what they're doing.
That are doing something nobody understands.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. I love it when there are things that seem like should be obvious, but ongoing scientific mysteries. I think that's part of the wonder of the universe. And yeah, I like how we can still explore these little corners of the world.
Welcome back. You are listening to Lost in Science. And I want you to imagine for a second that you are out camping. Maybe you are out camping. You're lying on the ground, looking up at the stars. There's no moon. And then you start to see this glow that's not quite a cloud. You start to get a little bit of color in it. It starts to move around. Imagine seeing that. Imagine seeing that, you know, 60,000 years ago, 40,000 years ago, even 500 years ago.
Would you think it was like spirits or fairies or something like that? Or
Absolutely you would. Surely you would. I feel like that's a topic for another episode. The creation stories or the fairy tales or the religious tales that have evolved that may have roots in celestial phenomena like the aurora. But for the last few hundred years, we have known that aurora australis, the southern lights, and aurora borealis, the northern lights, occur when there is a mass ejection or there is a large, strong solar storm or solar wind that comes from the sun smashing into Earth, interacting with oxygen and nitrogen in our atmosphere, creating those beautiful colours. And many people over the last couple of years have been lucky enough to see, here in Australia, see the Southern Lights. We are in a solar maximum at the moment, a solar peak, where we've got a peak time of sunspots of solar flares kind of coming out of the sun. And now this happens around about every 11 years. It can be around 9 to 14 years. And what happens at this solar maximum time is that the sun's magnetic field actually flips. So the North Pole becomes a South Pole and the South Pole becomes a North Pole.
So when you say activity, like an solar peak of activity, is it activity in terms of this kind of like magnetic fields and things being put out? Or is it also like the light and heat as well, is that increased at this time?
That is quite an interesting question, because there are some theories in some corners of the internet that say that the world's weather and climate is driven, like climate variations are driven by these sunspot variations. And so when we have this solar maximum, we get a peak of sunspot activity, and these sunspots are when the magnetic field of the sun is so intense that it blocks convective heat flow to the surface. Right, okay. Right? So if you're looking at just the visible spectrum from the sun is actually a bit dimmer, right? So there was a period where people thought that the sun was a bit weaker during the solar maximum.
Oh, okay.
Because on the visible spectrum, it wasn't quite as bright. But because there are more spots, yeah. And so if you want to say, all right, there's a little bit less energy coming from the sun. So if anything, a solar maximum would be associated with slightly, very, very, very slightly cooler temperatures. But in recent years, researchers have realized that there's an increase in ultraviolet light because there's all sorts of other things being shot out, right? And so if you look at the sun in different ways, then there's actually a slight increase in the amount of energy that comes from the sun during that solar maximum. Yeah, it is quite interesting.
And so for all those, I just want to point out for those like climate deniers out there who don't listen to our show that, yes, climate scientists like Lyndon are aware that the sun exists and does change its activity.
Look, the change in the amount of energy from the solar maximum to a solar minimum, and there's kind of peaks, some maximums are bigger than others, and that's a longer cycle. But the difference is about 1 watt per square meter,
okay,
right? So you get a little bit less or a little bit more energy. But the solar constant, the amount of energy that we get from the sun generally, is around 1,360 watts per square meter. So it's not a very big change at all. And researchers from the US estimated that the temperature might change on the planet by 0.01 degree.
Okay. And then it's going to change back again fairly quickly. So,
exactly. Anyway, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about auroras. Colours.
What can you tell us?
Okay, so that's one cycle you need to know about, the 11-year solar cycle, right? We're coming down off a maximum now. It maxed in late 2024. But as things are kind of, as we come down from the maximum, I think there's still a higher than average chance of auroras for the next few years. Another cycle that's kind of interesting, I didn't realize, is that the sun, you know how we rotate once a day, the sun also rotates, right? So we see the same-ish section of the sun around about every 27 days, which I didn't know either. So if there's a huge sunspot in one spot that appears at one part, you know how long it's going to take to get back until it's sort of facing Earth. So to get a good, strong aurora, you want a big-ass sunspot around the center of the sun, like the sun's equator, I suppose, facing right towards us. So that's two cycles that maybe you didn't know about before. 11 years, 27 days. But there are also two acronyms that you may have seen on many of the Facebook groups or sort of been floated around by any of your mates who are particularly keen on this stuff. The first is the K index, and that is the magnitude of the storm that's happening on the sun. So the K index indicates how strong a storm's going to be. But if the storm is particularly strong, and that's a K index value of 5 or greater, so that May 2024 event, I think, was a K index of 9, and the event that happened earlier this year, I believe, was an 8. You also need the magnetic field of the solar wind that's coming from the sun to be pointed sort of downwards, because that is the best way that the solar wind can interact with our magnetic field on Earth. I think that's what it means. So if you've got a really strong storm, but the orientation's not quite right, then it's not going to interact with our atmosphere, with our ionosphere, and with our own magnetic field. And that is determined by the BZ number, or the BZ index. I tried to figure out what that stands for and I was defeated. So again, please let us know. But the more negative that number is,
BZ,
the better.
It probably has something to do with magnetic fields. You know, there's the B is a symbol for magnetic field.
So you want a K index that's pretty good, 5+. You want a BZ index that's negative, the more negative, the better. And if it's negative for a longer period of time, then that is really good as well. So like negative 10, negative 20 for at least an hour or so. You want to be going somewhere dark where there's no bright lights to your south and looking up towards the sky. And then depending on the intensity of the storm, that generally determines the colors that you will see. So green is the most common color that you would have seen in photos of the northern lights or the southern lights. That's oxygen in the lower part of the high part of the atmosphere, so up to around 240 kilometers above the surface of the earth. And then it kind of goes to red. So it's a really intense storm, like that May 2024 one. There was a big red sky. Other colors, and I didn't realize this, you can get blue colors in your aurora. That is nitrogen in sort of below about 95 kilometers in the atmosphere, whereas above it would be purple. And the event that happened in January this year, there was a bit of purple I saw in pictures floating around. So the plasma from the solar storm interacts with those two elements to create those kinds of colors. So be somewhere south, facing south. Have it be nighttime. Fingers crossed it won't be a full moon. Fingers crossed it won't be cloudy. The last piece of information is that you want to be close to the pole, but not necessarily the geographic pole. You want to be as close as you can be to the geomagnetic pole, which in the Northern Hemisphere is actually on an island in Northern Canada. For the Southern geomagnetic pole is about 80 degrees south, kind of southwest of, I mean, it's on the Antarctic, it's on Antarctica, but southwest of sort of Adelaide.
So it's on our side of the world.
You know, Tasmania and the Southern Island of New Zealand, obviously they are further south, but, you know, maybe if you're in that Adelaide area or that Southern Australian region, you've got the slight edge as well because you're slightly closer to the Southern geomagnetic pole. So that's kind of a whistle-stop tour of things to think about when it comes to auroras. We probably still have a little bit more time before this solar maximum really backs off, and hopefully we might see a couple more events soon.
So where can people get forecasts of sun weather to find out these things?
Yeah, the Bureau of Meteorology has a space weather service. You can subscribe to the Bureau's mailing list and they'll send you an alert when there's a storm in progress. There's so many Facebook pages that exist, a lot of information on social media, but I would always suggest starting with the Bureau of Meteorology for your weather, whether it's meteorological or solar.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.